Okay. So tonight. Okay. Deborah Bogans. Most recent book, Let Me Open You a Swan, won the 2009 Anti-Vellum Prize from Elixir Press. Her full-length collection, Landscape with Silos, won the Kennedy Poetry Prize. And her poetry and her reviews appear widely. And as many of you know, she runs a much admired workshop in Highland Park. And it's great to welcome here to her tonight, Deborah Bogan.
This room, I love this room. Splits my head. Okay, whatever, right? It's fine. However you do it, it'll be fine. Can y'all hear me? I'm sure you can. I have a big old voice. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. And I'm going to try to do this with two rooms. It always is amazing here. Thank you for coming, and thanks for inviting me again, Joan. And I do have these two books, which you'd expect me to be reading from tonight. But frankly, I'm sick of them. I've been reading from them a lot all year, as I'm supposed to do, and I have. And I do love them. But I just decided to read new work tonight. And there's a tradition in this room of that, because I've come to readings here where people have just decided to read all new stuff, and so I thought I could do that, so I'm going to. And then I'll find out if it's going to be revised. So I have 15 minutes, yes? Okay. No, I got an email. I'm going to worry. All right. So I have this serious religious background that gets into a lot of what I write, and an ongoing sort of tension that from that. And lately I've noticed I'm starting to write poems that are my own scripture, I've decided. And so I'm going to read two of those tonight, and the first one's called Scripture Regarding Hope. Today I received a gift, 6 blossomy blue stones. My sister, they mean something. They mean the blood feuds may be ending among the gods. So don't stir the trash or stare too much. Just cock the trap and walk away on foggy feet, because my sister, the world's bruised heart, desires privacy. That fissured heart has not been truly plumbed. Good ideas still flicker near freeways and garbage cans. And even though the hives have been deserted, the possibility of bees is not erased. So keep breathing, my sister, and leave that trash alone. Avoid those unstrung by sleep or death, and step softly, keeping your eyes on the path. Remember, my sister, evil-eyed is still a verb in Greek. So my husband's a musician forever, and for 35 years he played jazz clarinet before he became a banjoist, which he is now. And if you have ever been around a reed player, you know there is a obsession to find the perfect reed. And you just get sucked into it, even if you live in the same house with one of these people, because they're nuts to find the perfect reed. And whatever reed they get, it's not right, and it will fail soon if it's working. So this is called Scripture Regarding That Meat. An angel came down, saying, "Yea, a reed is chosen. And although the wood is old and the keys flat and fingered, although it comes easily apart and lies there, drooling spit, the angel, he still comes, saying, behold, it's made to make that certain clamor, that baleful, joyful noising. And thus, a rising up's required, and an angry, fertile lip. Therefore, my sisters, you find them in pawn shops, therefore in back rooms and bars, men twisting small screws testing worn paths, each one hewing and howling in the key of regret. For my sisters, they do aspire. They aspire, and ardently they seek the heat of the beast. Look how they crave it, that meat, that heart, and the sound that drops into the heart, that seed. Thank you. So recently we had Memorial Day, and I was watching some of the ceremony on television, and it reminded me that among the various research projects I have going for POMS is one on child soldiers. And when you first go into that area, you expect to find a lot of what you do find. You find a lot of, quote, third world or worse countries than ours with child soldiers. But I did find a quote that kind of amazed me. You can join the military when you're 17 in our military, but you're not supposed to be put into warlike, dangerous situations until you're 18. But unfortunately, they had to recently issue a sort of an apology because it turns out that 60 17-year-olds were accidentally sent into battle in Afghanistan and Iraq recently. And this poem is called Arlington. One. It's not true that rain begets cemeteries. Bodies bring us here where things are wet and springy, where even the turf breathes so that we find dirt and the dead, a difficulty requiring both lawnmower and invocation. But why the horn-heavy band? Why the guns and chaplains stiff as spoons? Wired to styrofoam, the flowers look like props in a high school musical. Two. Some things are said about the war, about the nation and gratitude, about sacrifice, etc., etc., etc. 17 is not okay, but accidents happen, and they looked so much older in their uniforms. Three, we're not done yet. Now these are flown, these birds. We have their bodies, but the thoughts are gone, and gone the last word. We don't have it. Skeletons stretch for miles here, toe to toe to toe. So other weird things I've been thinking about. I went to this amazing wedding this year. Thank you. And weddings are strange. I mean, they're truly deeply strange if you really go and watch them. And so I've been trying to write some poems about weddings that are sort of from a different point of view than the sort of happy bride and groom. And I'm only reading one tonight, but this is called The Organist's Premonition. They show up wearing skates, shiny blades, and creased white leather. Suddenly ice, and the wind's keening, but the bride looks gay in her costume, and the groom has his mother's permission. And it's tender, really, the way he lifts the veil, a corner between the thumb and forefinger of each hand to honor what she purchased at the beauty shop. Beyond the church, deacons and conifers circle the pond that's become their dance floor, the streetlights spotlighting the couple. And see, there are gloves and sequins, flowers and candles, and on the ice, couples engaging, then shying away, their arms in odd but adequate embrace. In here, the flower girls hold hands to keep from crying, while the girl, the woman, I mean, our bride, keeps gliding and stopping, gliding and stopping, and we all stand to watch. Okay, I'm going to try to read a long, funny poem. And I don't write funny poems. Anybody who's ever heard me or my books, like I write books called Living by the Children's Cemetery. And so this was a new venture for me, but Bob Hickok was here last year. And after he read all these really tough, serious poems, he closed with this funny poem. And I thought, party trick. I want to learn to do that. So harder than I thought, but I'm going to try it anyway. And especially hard to read, because if you write these wispy little delicate sad things, you can find them on the page, but at the age of my eyes and everything, it gets harder. I'm going to give it a shot. This is called In the Good Old Summertime. It was a hot afternoon in 1958 in Casper, Wyoming, and my parents were having drinks on the patio with the Bellinghams when Barbara Bellingham removed her blouse and served gin and tonic in her maiden form bra on the premise that it was hot and we're all friends, and really it's just the same as a bathing suit top, which made my mother choke on an ice cube, but Bob Bellingham got up and whacked her right between the shoulder blades, which sent that ice cube clear across the grass to where we kids were playing croquet and trying not to look at our parents or hear Mrs. Bellingham say, "My, that was a close call. I think Bob just saved your life, and it makes me feel like we're all so close," while my father sat on a lawn chair, leaning forward like he was on the John, and then shook the ice in his glass, but gently, like he was trying to get just the right sound. And my mother looked in her purse for a tissue and her dark red lipstick. And Bob said, "Well, that was exciting. I better run upstairs and change this shirt. There's gin all over it." And then he looked right at my mother and said, "Say, if you need to freshen up, there's a powder room right at the top of the stairs." And Mrs. Bellingham asked my dad if she could freshen up that drinky winky, which even we kids could understand. So we tried not to look at each other. And Janie said she left her book in the car. And Kenny said, "Did I want to ditch this dumb family barbecue?" Because there was a creek two blocks over there where he'd found some cigarette butts the other day. And I thought, well, the sun's so hot and croquet's really a dumb game. And Janie's gone to the car. And Kenny's sister Marie is only 8. And she looks like some kind of cross-eyed retard. So I said, "Okay. And I have a pretty good rock collection, and maybe there'll be some good rocks down by the creek." And Kenny said, "Aren't you kind of old for a rock collection?" But I told him it was a real collection with actual gemstones and some agates and petrified wood. And besides, I had a piece of jasper. And he said, "God, you talk a lot. Let's just go and see if we can find some more butts, because I got some matches off my old man. And if we can't smoke, maybe we'll find something to burn." So I followed him out the gate, thinking this is better than the time we snuck into the closet, pretending we wanted to see the clock numbers glow in the dark, because usually it's cool by the creek and rocks look good underwater, all expensive and magic-y, and I did like it, the kissing. And if we kissed, he would forget about the cigarette butts, which was a definite plus. And then maybe I'd find some good rocks to take back and show my parents, although I knew they'd say they weren't real gemstones, not collector's items, and that they couldn't see how kids our age could spend so much time down by the creek. And then they'd smile at each other and at me and Kenny, and then Mr. Bellingham would say, "Guess it's time to get those steaks on the grill. Want to give me a hand, Russ?" And he and my dad would go around the back of the garage and douse a bunch of charcoal with lighter fluid and probably have another drink. And pretty soon, Mrs. Bellingham would get impatient and yell, "Hurry up, Bob. What the hell are you two Don Juans up to back there?" And Mr. Bellingham would holler back, "For Christ's sake, Barbara, keep your shirt on."
Yay, good for you guys.
That's a really long joke. I'm still in here. Okay, all right. So, all right, they're not so funny after that. See, I'm in trouble. Okay, so less funny, maybe, but still true. I guess one of the other weird things I'm writing, see, it's great in this day and age. You can write things and say, "This is a poem. Go ahead and tell me this isn't a poem. I can show you a magazine who will say this." So in our writing group in Highland Park, one time Ellen led the group one night and gave this direction, which turned into this piece here. So this is called On Being Asked to Write About Art as an Abstraction. Art, like a wood stove built long after wood stoves were a necessity, has purposes both obvious and secret, frivolous and weighty as death. Think of the wood stove in the shed where a girl bent over Aquinas' argument has stacked a pile of magazines close to its hot belly. Like that stove, Art is possibly helpful, possibly dangerous, possibly decorative, possibly essential, possibly dirty, probably dirty, and full of windows for watching flames eat. That's how it fails as abstraction. The there-ness of art is its changeable windows, darkening, then exciting, as if conflagration was the word filling your mouth. Art's intentions move through museums in search of eyes through which they can slither into brain. Words on page flirt and wink, enticing the brain, the brain, the brain. This is as close as they get to that birth moment when someone's mistake created glory or destruction. On the page, art's ambitions stumble over the man bewailing his age. They hope to find rain trees or a reaching out to the world. Meanwhile, beneath cathedrals, folios flake and fade. In the arch is movement, and in the colored glass ornament, in the buttress, there is the essence of a grand conception. But none of this is art. Art is the mind's confusion imposed on the invisible instability of the world. And there you are, in the darkened room of the optometrist, with his battery of lenses. He places them in combinations before your captive eyes, asking, which is better, this or this?
Well, this is the sort of end of reading poem, so I'll read it. What some call loneliness. When you enter the last place, the vision before you is your own. The child on the three-legged stool, or a girl jumping rope, or some other thing, a deer grazing beneath cottonwood. What some call loneliness is just life, a portal you slip through to pull your harpsichord lungs over the last rim rock, sandstone hot to the touch. And if you're lucky, no witness, no tear-stained prayer shawls, just you sucking in that last breath. It smells of pine. Thank you.